Sanghe chu tang so ki cho nam la jang tu bar du dag ni kya su chi dag yi jin zo gi bi zo nam gi dro la pen ji zang gi du par shu. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratnamandala Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samayela. Okay, welcome. Sakya Pandit is clarifying the sage's intent. Sakya Pandita is leading us through the six perfections. We just have one more section here on the chapter on meditative concentration before we move on to the chapter on wisdom. And Sakya Pandita, in his discourse about meditation, he did not go into the mechanics of meditating so much as he went into the themes or the subjects or the objects for the perfection of meditation. So he talked about developing the four immeasurables as a precursor to developing loving-kindness, compassion, enlightenment, thought, equalizing self and others, and exchanging self and others. And so that was the approach that he took for the discourse. There is a section here on how to cultivate compassion. His Holiness the 42nd Sakya Treason said about this: "Let us now study the aspects in regard to the cultivation of great compassion, the objects of compassion." The objects of compassion can be explained in two ways: distinct objects and combined objects. Even though our compassion should extend to all sentient beings without differentiation, we classify the objects of our compassion in different groups to train our mind step by step. This will enable us to eventually extend our compassion to all beings. In the ornament of Mahayana Sutras, the Buddha Maitreya mentions 10 objects worthy of compassion. The teachings sometimes do this. They sometimes break down who we should have compassion for. Because it's fairly easy to say, oh, I have compassion for all sentient beings, but that's a big topic, all sentient beings. And most of us don't live our lives thinking that way. We think of the people that we know or that we run into or that we care about or that we have some kind of relationship with in some way or another. I'm reminded of that Peanuts cartoon where Lucy says, "I love mankind, it's people I can't stand." So this discussion about breaking down the groups is a little bit like that. In order to make it more doable and more specific in terms of, well, we're developing compassion for certain people or certain groups, it takes it down from this big, big group of all sentient beings and allows us to focus. And so this section that we're going to read now is divided into distinct objects and combined objects, and then the distinct objects, there are 10 categories. The first one is those inflamed, which refers to those who have strong desire for sense pleasures. So anyone who is very attached and focused on sense pleasures of any kind, it could be somebody who's obsessed about food or music or, I don't know, anything where it isn't a healthy interest, but it's an obsession or a compulsion. They are referred to as being inflamed. Anybody who's addicted to anything, I suppose. The second category is those dominated by an enemy, which means those who cannot engage in Dharma practice because they are under the control of internal obstacles or maras, which can sometimes manifest in the form of external enemies or obstacles. That might be somebody who's in a political situation where they're not allowed to practice, for example, in an oppressive society with an oppressive government. There's plenty of those around. Or, as it says here, it might be somebody who has an internal obstacle which then gets projected out and manifested as an external object. So I'm thinking of somebody that I know who's paranoid. They are seriously paranoid. And so their world vision is that there are constantly people that are after them or out to hurt them or that are creating problems for them or that are conspiring something or another against them. They're very susceptible to conspiracy theories. But it's really their internal state that's creating that, because they have been diagnosed as being seriously paranoid. So that's an internal state which is projected outward. The third one is those oppressed by suffering, which means those who are overwhelmed by the suffering of the three lower realms. So obviously the suffering there is very intense, and those beings are objects of compassion of our practice. The fourth one is those obscured by darkness, which refers to those who constantly engage in evil activities. For example, an immoral livelihood. Mm-hmm. One of the examples that's given is gun runners. Mm-hmm. That's considered an immoral activity of livelihood. And so people who have, it's their job, they're doing it all the time, so they're constantly creating non-virtue. The fifth one is those embarked on a path difficult to travel, which means those who will never attain nirvana. Now, if we go all the way back to the very beginning of Sakyapandita's text, there's a fairly extensive discussion of propensity. There's a little bit of a debate between the Yogacara school and the Madhyamaka school. We're going to talk about the two schools later. The Yogacara school says that there are some beings who have just accumulated so much negative karma that they're just never going to get out of samsara. The Madhyamaka school says No, that's not true. Everybody has Buddha nature. All beings have Buddha nature, and so there's the potential there for Buddhahood. But then they turn around and say, but samsara is never going to end. So in effect, the Madhyamaka school is saying more or less the same thing that the Yogacara school is saying, which is that there are some people that are really just loaded down with negative karma and they're never going to get out of it. And so those beings warrant our compassion. The sixth one is those who possess great fetters, which refers to those afflicted by self-grasping, which is the cause of all the sufferings of samsara, and those who follow non-Buddhist paths, thus reinforcing wrong views based on the belief in a self. And that's pretty much everybody who's a non-Buddhist believes in the self. And according to Buddhist doctrine, that's the cause of our suffering, is this misconception about the self, which really isn't there. And so we commit all kinds of non-virtue protecting our self. Number seven is those attached to food mixed with poison, which refers to attachment to the bliss of mundane meditative concentration, which will block the path to gain liberation. Just as food mixed with poison may taste delicious at first, but will eventually kill us. This refers to beings who practice meditation, and as we've said before, some of these meditations, when you get accomplished at them, they produce the side effect of bliss. For some practitioners, the bliss becomes a distraction, that they become attached to the bliss. The problem with that is, one of the problems with that is, you can end up in the form or the formless realms. That's really not where you want to be, because first of all, those are considered God realms or heavenly realms, and so when you're in that realm, you don't suffer. As a result of not suffering, you don't practice. And as a result of not practicing, you don't accumulate good karma and merit. The problem with that is that when your karma or your merit ends in that realm, you haven't accomplished any more practice or any more merit, and so there's nowhere to go except down. That is more or less the height of samsara, in a sense. And so you fall. And the landing is a hard landing. It's because you got attached to the bliss. That is a huge mistake. So the bliss that occurs as a byproduct needs to be kept in perspective. And we need not to get attached to it. Those beings are called those attached to food mixed with poison. Number eight is those who destroy the path, which refers to non-Buddhists who take pride in certain practices they believe to be the path of liberation, but which in fact can destroy the true path. So an example of that would be a belief system that practices human sacrifice or animal sacrifice or some sort of non-virtuous activity mistakenly thought of to be virtuous. Or it could be a practice like thinking, if I go into a certain river and wash, all my sins are taken away. According to Buddhism, that's not the way it works. Those are beings that think they are on a path, but they're not really. Number nine is those who have taken a wrong road. Some texts translate that as those who have taken a crooked path. That refers to a path that takes much longer to reach the final destination. And this refers to those who have embarked on the path of the foundation path, which takes much, much, much longer. This would be like if you had a GPS in your car, and either the GPS was malfunctioning, or sometimes the GPSs just send you on the wrong road. I think probably everybody who has a GPS has had that experience at some point. And as a result of going down the wrong road, it takes you a lot longer to arrive to where it is you want to go. Also because you wouldn't be using the GPS if you knew where you were going in the first place. If you take a path that takes much, much, much longer, which the foundation path takes, remember this is a Mahayana great vehicle teaching, so from the Mahayana point of view, the foundation path, the goal is nirvana. If you reach that, you go into this meditative state for eons and eons. Some texts say 40 great eons. It's unimaginable how long that is. It's billions of years. And during that time, you're not helping any sentient beings, whereas a bodhisattva would be. So eventually, the Mahayana teaching is that eventually, at a certain point, the Buddha will go and wake those people up, those beings, sort of wake them up from their deep meditation, and set them on the Mahayana path. But then they have to start over from the beginning of the Mahayana path. And eventually they do the Mahayana path, and eventually they become enlightened. So it is a valid path, but it just takes a super long time. So from the Mahayana point of view, that's not the way to go. Because we want to help sentient beings. And then the tenth one is those who are weak, which refers to those beginner bodhisattvas who are intoxicated by mental afflictions and therefore cannot accumulate the heaps of merit and wisdom to a great extent. So if somebody's just starting out on the path, which we all do at some point or another, you don't know anything, it's all confusing, you're probably doing your practice wrong, it takes a while to sort things out, and it takes some practice to do the practice correctly. There's a saying, practice doesn't make perfect, perfect practice makes perfect. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing the practice and you're doing it wrong, you're not really accumulating the merit that you would be accumulating if you were doing the practice correctly. The beginner bodhisattvas are objects of compassion. These are the objects of compassion separated into different classes of beings. Now His Holiness continues saying, cultivating compassion towards all objects combined is the next step. As it said in the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras by Maitreya, quote, when the Tathagata had entered into that expanse, seated atop the lofty peak, he gazed down upon beings. If he felt compassion for minds that delight in quiescence, what need is there to mention minds that delight in existence? This existence refers to inherent existence, which is a mistaken belief that we're going to get into in the next chapter. That's the end of the quote by Maitreya. His Holiness continues, from the peak of a high mountain, all the places below can be seen. Though some may be higher than others, all are visible from the mountaintop. Similarly, the Buddha sees both samsara and nirvana as places of suffering and dissatisfaction, and therefore has compassion for all sentient beings who are in either state. The objects of compassion in cyclic existence include beings who contribute to the causes of suffering and those who experience the result of suffering. Beings who contribute to the causes of suffering refers to those who, in terms of the preparation or basis, hold unwholesome intentions, and then strive to gain followers, wealth, and the like with such intentions. In terms of the actual deed, it refers to those who harm the guru, the three jewels, and sentient beings. It also refers to those who follow a mistaken spiritual path that leads to rebirth in the lower realms. Even though, generally speaking, all sentient beings are object of our compassion, here the teachings emphasize those who are committing serious negative actions, which are the cause of their own suffering. Actually, when we speak of the true Buddha Dharma, we are not referring to something outside of ourselves, something depending on factors other than ourselves. The true Buddha Dharma is found within, and it is none other than keeping our vows and progressing within them. The true Buddha Dharma is neither in the texts nor in the temples, statues, or tankas. However, if we can connect all these external factors with our mind and with our vows, they can become conditions that support our practice and our accumulation of merit. If we have the wrong perception, thinking, for instance, that the actual Dharma resides in statues or temples, we may become angry when someone damages them. In that case, we would be sacrificing the true Dharma within ourselves to protect the conditions for it, when in actuality it should be the other way around. It is our anger that damages our vows, which are the real Dharma, not the perceived external enemies who damage statues or temples, which we may mistake to be the real Dharma. There is no genuine Dharma practice that is not related to maintaining and enhancing our vows. Sometimes we may think that we are justified in being angry at those who damage monasteries or harm our guru, the three jewels, our sentient beings. However, we must realize that anger will not uphold or protect the Dharma at any time, anywhere. Anger is always a cause of suffering, and it destroys the true Dharma. Therefore, we should instead generate compassion towards such people who are committing serious negative actions. We should also develop compassion for those who are experiencing suffering as a result of having committed negative actions. Every sentient being experiences suffering to varying degrees. In the three lower realms, beings experience more intense suffering than those who are in the three higher realms, and within the three higher realms, there is a difference in the nature of the suffering. For example, all human beings share the sufferings of sickness, anxiety, being separated from loved ones, of coming across people they don't like, old age, faint-heartedness, and so forth. In short, all those who are experiencing suffering are the object of our compassion. So that is a discussion about compassion and various ways of looking at the objects of our practice of compassion. And that concludes the chapter on meditative concentration. Any questions about that topic? Okay, so we will continue on to chapter 9, which is the perfection of wisdom. The perfection of wisdom is considered to be the most important perfection. The perfections are in a certain order for various reasons, and one of the reasons is increasing importance as we go. So the perfection of wisdom is the jewel teaching that the Buddha brought, which is unique. Shantideva said all the previous perfections are taught as a preparation for the perfection of wisdom. So as we start with generosity, morality, and so on and so forth, we build up our practice, so to speak. And the final two perfections, meditation and wisdom, are really important. Meditation is important because wisdom cannot be realized by any other method except meditation. So we have to know how to meditate, we have to know how to do it correctly, what the objects are, what the downfalls are, and so on, which we covered in the last chapter, in order to realize the realization of wisdom, which, in very simple terms, is enlightenment. This topic is not only very large, but very difficult. So we're going to do the best we can here to understand it. And in order to do that, I want to start with the commentary that Ape Rinpoche makes about this chapter, The Perfection of Wisdom. Ape Rinpoche says, the sixth perfection is the perfection of wisdom. Wisdom is defined as the correct realization of the real nature of phenomena. This realization becomes the actual perfection of wisdom when it is conjoined with the preparation, which is the enlightenment thought, and the conclusion, which is the dedication of merit. The opposing force to wisdom is wrong understanding. As we've gone through all of these chapters and all these different perfections, the first thing we always, besides the definition, which is the first thing, but after that, we immediately need to identify what is the antithesis. What's the problem, and how do we confront it, basically. So in this case, the antithesis is wrong understanding. One of the interesting things about Sakyapandita's discussion about wisdom is he includes a vast view of wisdom, which includes not only high spiritual realization, the realization of the true nature of reality, but he also includes what we would just call normal wisdom, that is, good judgment, good sense, knowledge, being able to discern situations in a way that's beneficial. The wise king, or the wise ruler, the wise emperor. So he includes all of those in his discussion of wisdom, which I find that kind of interesting. Ape Rinpoche continues by saying, the unfavorable result of lacking wisdom during this life is that we will always experience problems. We won't understand what to do and what to avoid doing. Those who possess wisdom understand the nature of reality, whereas those who lack wisdom cannot understand the nature of reality any more than a wolf can sit in the place of a lion. If we lack wisdom, we won't develop a steady mind. Instead, our mind will be timid and won't be of benefit either to ourselves or to others. Not only will we be unable to understand the scriptures, we will also not even possess worldly understanding. We will have no means by which to judge which actions to undertake and which to avoid. One who lacks wisdom will not be able to make progress on the path of Dharma. Just as a sick person cannot function properly, a person who lacks wisdom will not be able to undertake the practices properly and accomplish them. For example, if we attempt to meditate without an understanding of the doctrine, we will not be able to accomplish the purpose of the meditation. In the Abhidharma Kosha, the treasury of knowledge, the great Vasubandhu stated that without wisdom, one cannot pacify the afflictions which keep sentient beings wandering in the ocean of samsara. If we lack wisdom, therefore, we will not be able to discriminate between deeds to be adopted and deeds to be abandoned, and consequently, we will be unable to perform virtuous actions. And regardless of where we are reborn, we will have inferior faculties. And due to our dull faculties, even if we practice, it will be the wrong practice. And if we meditate, we will be unable to uproot self-grasping. And even if we do manage to diminish self-grasping, we will only be able to enter the cessation of the foundation path. Therefore, possessing wrong understanding brings about many disadvantages, not only during the present lifetime, but also in the future. Wrong understanding is the opposing force to wisdom, and there are two ways to overcome it. Number one, by countering its cause, or number two, by countering it directly. So countering the cause of wrong understanding. The cause of wrong understanding is ignorance. The method for overcoming ignorance is, first of all, to study the doctrine, and then to contemplate on it. So we're always talking about listening, contemplation, meditation. But Apirimshe only lists two of those here. And that's because later on we'll be going into the meditation aspect of this in some detail. But before we get there, he has a comment to make, which is the contributing condition to wrong understanding is relying on a bad teacher. To prevent this possibility, we should find an authentic teacher who understands the doctrine well. And once we have met a teacher, we need to examine them to ensure that they possess both wisdom and proper conduct. If we find a teacher who has both of these qualities, then they can be relied on. However, even if the teacher has good morality, unless they understand the meaning of the doctrine, they cannot help us overcome ignorance. Therefore, we need a teacher who not only has good morality, but who also understands the true meaning of the doctrine. Therefore, the way to overcome ignorance is to study and contemplate under the guidance of a good teacher. So that is the first method, which is countering the cause of wrong understanding. The second, which is directly countering the result of wrong understanding, Apirimshe says this: the direct method for overcoming the result in wrong understanding is to produce and further develop correct understanding. First of all, we must be able to distinguish between mistaken understanding and correct understanding. Then we must refute the former and establish the latter. With regard to refuting mistaken understanding, there are two divisions. Refuting mistaken understanding of non-Buddhist schools and refuting mistaken understanding of other Buddhist schools. So first of all, refuting the mistaken understanding of the non-Buddhist schools. The first section is presenting their views. Although there are many non-Buddhist schools, they may be broadly classified into two categories: those who expound eternalism and those who expound nihilism. Eternalism is the view of an inherently and permanently existing self, which remains even after liberation is attained. When that permanent self is bound by karma and afflictions, it's said to be in samsara. And when that self frees itself from karma and afflictions, that permanent self is regarded as having been liberated. That's the mistaken view. Okay, one of them. Nihilism, on the other hand, is the view that the self exists inherently while the sentient being is alive, but then ceases at death. In other words, nihilists accept only this life. The nihilists also claim that there is no logic apart from what is perceived. In other words, whatever is seen in this life exists, and whatever is not seen does not exist. They do not accept a continuum of cyclic existence after death, nor do they accept the liberation of nirvana. I've actually known some people who believe that. They think this life is that's it. There's no afterlife. There's no heaven, hell, or anything else. And when it's over, it's over. Poof. Which, besides being kind of depressing, I would think there would be a risk then that your morality would slip, because if there's no consequence, you can pretty much do whatever you want. Even though, I mean, hopefully people don't, but if you just believe that this is it and there's no consequence, there's no afterlife or anything. I haven't met too many people like that, but there are people like that. Whereas the eternalists, they believe that the self actually exists, and it's permanent, and it's solid, it's real, and so forth. From a Mahayana point of view, those are both extremes. The Mahayana view is not actually in the middle. It's completely out of that way of looking at things completely. The eternalist-nihilist continuum is one way of describing people's belief system, but as we will see, the Mahayana point of view doesn't have anything to do with either one of those. So we'll go into that. That is the presentation of the non-Buddhist schools. Now Api Rinpoche is going to refute those views. He says, by simply cutting through the view of the self of person and the self of phenomena, one can understand that all phenomena lack inherent existence, and therefore one is free from both of these extreme views. In a way, the solution is simple. We just cut through the view of the belief of the self of person and phenomena. Easier said than done, but it solves the two extremes of the non-Buddhist views. He elaborates, Rinpoche goes on by saying, as it's said in the Madhyamaka Avatara, there's a difference between the person and the self of person. The self of person signifies the inherent or substantial person. There's also a difference between cognizable things and the self of a cognizable thing. The mere cognizable thing refers to form, sound, and other objects of sensory and mental perception. The self of a cognizable thing refers to its inherent existence. The view that phenomena exist inherently is refuted by the analytical reasoning of non-arising from the four extremes, and the view of self of person is refuted through the analysis of the five modes. And we will go through those in a minute. If one attains an intellectual understanding of the non-existence of the self of person and the self of phenomena, through applying these two sets of reasonings, one can overcome wrong speculative views of nihilism and eternalism. Okay, so what does all that mean? First of all, we're going to refute those two extremes through logic. This is part of listening, contemplating. Later on, we're going to meditate on this, but for now, we need to go through the logical part of it or the rational part of it. Rinpoche mentioned two of these systems. The analytical reasoning of the four extremes is set out in detail in the Madhyamaka Avatara by Chandrakirti, which is available in several English translations. The reasoning demonstrates that things do not arise from themselves, from others, from both self and others, or without a cause. So just to repeat those things, do not arise from themselves, from others, from both self and others, or without a cause. In Chandrakirti's writings, he goes into these in detail, obviously. And by going through that reasoning that he presents, we can negate the self. The analysis of the five modes uses a chariot as the basis of analogy to demonstrate the non-existence of a personal self in the following way. Number one, there is no chariot which is other than its parts. So you have the parts, you have the wheels. Obviously, chariot was what they got around in those days. You can think of your car. So you have, your car has wheels, it has doors, it has steering wheel, it has a windshield, hopefully. It has all those parts, but none of those parts are the car. They are the parts. So we impose the label car on all those parts that come together. That's the first one, is there's no chariot other than the parts. The second one is there is no chariot which is the same as the parts. So there's no label that's away from all of these parts, but also the parts themselves are not the label. Number three, there is no chariot which inherently possesses its parts. Where is the car that possesses the steering wheel and the door and the windshield? There is no separate entity. There is no car entity. Number four, there is no chariot which inherently depends on its parts. Again, you can't separate the label out that's dependent upon the parts. There is no such thing. Number five, there is no chariot on which its parts inherently depend. The tire or the wheel will still be a wheel and you can still roll it, regardless of whether you call it a chariot or a car or a pizza. It doesn't depend on the label. In the same way, when we look at an inherent self, we will not find it. Now, Chandrakirti later added two more points. So the 5 points become 7. Number six, there's no chariot which is a mere collection of its parts. That's number six. And number seven, there is no chariot which is the shape of its parts. This expanded analysis is known as the seven-point reasoning of the chariot. So that's a very famous logical reasoning that's studied in great deal in the philosophical colleges. And we're just listing them here without really discussing them or going into them. It's through the analysis of these two types of analysis that we refute the views. Now, that's refuting the non-Buddhist views. And then the second category is refuting the mistaken understanding of other Buddhist schools. As we know, there's many schools have developed over the time, over centuries, lots and lots of them. Apa Rinpoche says the Buddhist tradition is subdivided into two principal schools, the Mahayana Great Vehicle and the Foundation Path. The wisdom expounded by both schools is faultless. However, after the passing away of the Buddha, various schools of thought developed, and many of these schools introduced erroneous teachings on the views. This topic is divided into three subdivisions, refuting the Foundation Path tenets, refuting the contention of provisional Mahayana schools, and refuting teachings that are neither Foundation Path nor Mahayana. The first one, refuting Foundation Path, Apa Rinpoche says there are two Foundation Path philosophical schools, the Vaibhashika and the Sautantrika. Both claim that the mind is truly existent, and although they do not accept the true existence of gross form, they regard the tiniest indivisible atoms as truly existent. They maintain that there is a truly existent momentary consciousness which cannot be divided by time. There is no difference between these two schools with respect to accepting consciousness, but there are differences with regard to the characteristic nature of atoms. These schools only accept foundation teachings. They do not regard Mahayana scriptures as the teachings of the Buddha. The next category is refuting the contention that provisional Mahayana schools are definitive. With regard to the schools that uphold Mahayana tenets, there are two main schools, the Chittamatra school and the Madhyama school. Chittamatra is also referred to as Yogacara. And then each of those have two subdivisions, but we're not going to go into that because we would be here for a long time. There is no difference between the Chittamatra school and the Madhyamaka school regarding the presentation of the method of practice or conduct. The difference lies only in the view. Unlike the Chittamatra school, the Madhyamaka school does not accept any phenomena as truly existent. Rinpoche doesn't go into this here, but the Yogacara school appears to accept the mind or an aspect of the mind as truly existent. Everything else is not truly existent. Of course, there's lots of debate back and forth between these schools, and even though the Sakya school accepts the Madhyamaka as the final view, it doesn't totally throw out the Yogacara school, because the Yogacara school is very handy when it comes to actually practicing. Because when we practice, we use our mind. That's what we're practicing with primarily. It's useful as a practice tool, but it's not considered the ultimate view by the Sakyas. And there's lots and lots of debating around these topics. These are the main topics that are studied in the Sakya philosophical colleges and Shedras, and they're studied for many years. 8, 9, 10, 12, 15, 20 years. The philosophical studies are extensive. So we're just mainly just naming them now, just to give an overview. That is refuting the contention of the provisional schools, or school, really. In Sakyapandita's text, he goes into an extensive discussion of another category, which is teachings which are neither foundation school nor Mahayana. And he identifies four of these. The discussion is really extensive and sometimes very difficult. But basically, these are schools that present themselves as Mahayana, but that are not really. There's one which is called the White Panacea, which came from China, and there's a fairly famous Chinese master, Ho Shang, who brought it, and there's a long discussion about how the issue was resolved in Tibet by a debate between Kamala Shila and Ho Shang. Of course, Kamala Shila won. And then there's a second category that Sakyapandita talks about, which is sort of a second wave of that White Panacea. I guess it came later. It sort of followed up on the original White Panacea school. And that was refuted. And then Sakyapandita refers to two approaches, one which apparently still exists today, which has to do with a sub-school of the Chittamatran school, which presents their take on Mahamudra. And then the fourth one is also a school that grew out of Madhyamaka that presented their take on Mahamudra. And Sakyapandita refutes both of those. And again, as I said, there's extensive discussion about this, and people are welcome to go and read that if you want to go into great detail about all those. There's one more section here, which is how to meditate on these topics of emptiness, but emphasizing that you must include compassion. We can't just exclude that. So Apa Rinpoche says, meditating on emptiness without practicing compassion is not a correct practice, because it is not a cause for full and perfect enlightenment. Even if one possesses great faith in the teachings, renounces worldly existence, and meditates correctly on the selflessness of persons, but does so without employing the method practices such as loving-kindness and great compassion, one will only attain the result of personal liberation. Hence, it is apparent that the meditation on wisdom alone, although it may be a correct meditation, it will not lead to enlightenment. In fact, if one practices meditative concentration with insight wisdom of a conventional nature and overcomes the gross defilements of the desire realm, this will lead to rebirth in the form realm. If one's meditation develops further, and one abides in the realization that sees all phenomena as clear and empty like space, this will lead to rebirth in the sphere of infinite space, which is the first of the four formless realms. If one abides in the realization that sees all phenomena as the nature of mind, this will lead to rebirth in the sphere of infinite consciousness, the second formless realm. If one abides in the realization that sees nothingness, this will lead to rebirth in the sphere of nothingness, which is the third formless realm. And if one abides in the realization that sees all phenomena as neither existent nor non-existent, this will lead to rebirth in the sphere of neither existence nor non-existence, the fourth formless realm. In short, cultivating such meditations on emptiness, without realizing the selflessness of person and the selflessness of phenomena, will lead to rebirth within the form or formless realms. And it will not lead even to arhatship, let alone Buddhahood. So, even though these meditations may be extremely effective in certain ways, they are not a cause for liberating one from the realms of existence, because the results of these meditations fall within the three realms of cyclic existence. There are so-called practitioners with merits inferior to those who meditate on the formless meditations, who have not yet discarded the desirous attachment of the form realm, yet meditate on the inexpressible and think proudly, "I have realized phenomena." Such people are not devoted to the correct doctrine and will be reborn as long life gods in one of the eight restless states. The eight restless states are the hell realms, being born in the hungry ghost, being born as an animal, being born as a long life god, being born amongst barbarians who are ignorant of the teachings, being born with wrong views such as nihilism or eternalism, being born at a time or place where Buddha has not appeared, and being born deaf. There are others who, during the meditation on emptiness, think that there is absolutely no difference between virtue and non-virtue, since everything is in a state of emptiness, and consequently neither virtue nor non-virtue exists. And as a result of this belief, they may commit many non-virtuous deeds, despite the fact that they engage in meditation. If these people commit great non-virtue, they will be reborn in the hell realms. If they commit middling type of non-virtue, they will be reborn as hungry ghosts. And if they commit lesser non-virtue, they will be reborn as animals. I think we will stop there. There's more to come. So that's getting rid of the wrong views. Next time we will talk about the correct wisdom and how to establish that. It's a little bit intellectual, but it's an overview of the different schools, and where we're headed, of course, is Madhyamaka and how to do the Madhyamaka meditation, which is what the Sakyas hold. So nam dei tam che zig pani chob na ne pe da nam pam jete ke ga na chi ba lung tru pe yi sit pe tso le do a dru ar sho chung tru sem cho vim po che ma ke pa nam ke gyur che ke ma nyam par me par yang gong ne gong tu pel par sho jam pa pa o ji tar ken pa dong kun tu sang po yang de shin te de da ku gi je zu da lo che ge wa di da tam je ra du ngo jebi gyawa dam jeki no wa gangla chodu na pagi da jenge vedza wa di kung kyang sang po cho jira du no war gi jaksa wa dang cho jing sha pa dong jizu yi rang ru jing so wa yi ge wa chung ze da gi ji sak pa tam je zo pe jong chu chi. By this merit, may I all attain omniscience, and may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I might train to be like them. And through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.